Get started with the State Government Finance Committee. We do have quorum, and if Representative Uglem, you want to move the minutes for
us? Yes, Madam Chair, they look very good.
Okay, I assume there's no changes to the minutes for January 19th, 2017. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? The minutes for January 19th, 2017 are adopted. Members, we're going to jump around here a little bit today. The Historical Society right now is testifying in front of the Senate, but when they are back and available, I would like to probably stop where we're at, and I know that's hard for the folks that have come here today, but just be able to get that done and underway. It is a bonding bill that we would be looking at, and what we've done traditionally in the past on bonding bills is we move that to the Capital Investment Committee without recommendation by the committee. It just gives us an opportunity to kind of know the mechanics of this and if there's any potential liability for this committee. So with that and kind of knowing the lay of the land, I think what we will start with first is the State Board of Investment. If you guys want to come forward. They do have a PowerPoint presentation, but apparently we do not have a USB port. You have to bring your own laptop to do that. Which, you know, is boggles my mind. So, but we appreciate you trying to bring technology to the committee.
We can provide a handout.
Yes, and then also members, they have graciously offered to email the PowerPoint presentation to us as well. So once we get that, we'll be able to send them your emails. Okay? And they should have it already? Oh, excellent. John says that we already have it in our possession, so you'll be able to take a look at that electronically if you wish. So with that, we're going to start off. Do you want to state your name for the record and who you represent?
Yes.
We'll get ourselves rocking and rolling.
Madam Chairman and members, my name is Mansco Perry. I'm the Executive Director and Chief Investment Officer for the State Board of Investment. For some of you who don't know us, State Board of Investment.
Mr. Mansco,
yeah.
I apologize. Can you speak into the microphone? There's like a white noise back here that makes it hard to hear sometimes.
Okay.
So I apologize.
Is this better?
Yes, thank you. Appreciate it.
My name is Mansco Perry. I'm the Executive Director and Chief Investment Officer for the State Board of Investment. For those of you who don't know us, the State Board of Investment is authorized by Article 11 of the Constitution, and its members are the governor, state auditor, secretary of state, and the attorney general. We are assisted by a 17-member investment advisory council, 10 members of which are from the public, and they represent their chief investment officers from organizations like Target, 3M, Cargill, the Margaret A. Cargill Foundation, and others. And I run a staff of 26 people. I'd like to let everyone know we're not the pension plan, but we're responsible for managing state pension assets and other state monies, which includes the state cash accounts and some state trust funds. So with that, If you turn to the handout, the first slide, try to give you some semblance of and answer some of the questions that were outlined in the outline. As of the end of last fiscal year, we were responsible for about $81 billion. About 70-plus percent of that was pension assets, and the rest primarily were about $10 or $11 billion in state cash, and the residuals are the deferred comp plan and some trust funds that we manage. The staff and I are responsible for overseeing about 40 stock and bond managers who manage most of the monies. Those would be the likes of Goldman Sachs, and others that manage money for us. We also have about 80 private market managers, and we're responsible for about 200 private equity, real estate, oil and gas, private credit funds that pension assets are in. If you turn to the slide three, we receive a general appropriation from the general fund of about $139,000. The bulk of dollars in our budget are provided by dedicated receipts, a little less than $6 billion. And we also have a statutory appropriation of about $1 billion for consultants and accounting software that we use. We also use some clearing accounts, but that really is very minimal. The last several years, I've been in charge of the board staff for about the last 4 years, and each year I'm happy to say that we've always come in under budget and return dollars to those who fund us. We've made some headways in terms of lowering the management fees that our asset managers charge those. When I came back to the state board, we began a process of when contracts were up of being pretty hard, and we've been pretty successful in lowering the fees that we pay asset managers.
One moment, Mr. Perry. Representative Uglum.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So you talk about management fees from the various funds and things like that. What's the range on that, and is it stepped according to the amount of money that's in each fund?
Mr. Penny? Perry?
Yes, Madam Chairman, Representative. The way the funding works for, or the fees work for asset managers, for stock and bond managers, we usually negotiate a tiered system based on the amount of assets that we charge. It's unique to each of the managers we have, primarily active managers. You'll see it here. And what we'll have is for the first hundreds of millions of dollars, we'll pay so many basis points, the next year less and less, but that's all negotiated. We also have passive management, and in the past year, I've been changing the portfolio somewhat so that we are investing, at least in domestic equities, more money a little bit more passively. And one of the reasons for that is, again, looking at our fees. We've had varying results of our active management performance, but I've been able to negotiate on the passive side some pretty favorable fees. So to give you an example of the impact of that, let's just say, for an example, that we have a stock manager and we pay them on average 50 basis points, half a percent, yeah, in fees. I've been able to redivert that money to a passive manager. So with the active manager, for us to get pretty much the same amount in excess return over a benchmark that we pay the manager, if we're paying them 50 basis points, they'd have to make 100 basis points for us to have kind of an equal sharing of any return. If they make 50 basis points, they get 50, we get nothing. Anything less, we're dipping into our pocket, and I've had a major issue with that, particularly for managers who've underperformed. So we've been diverting money, and I was able to negotiate with our passive manager that we're paying them on the margin of our account less than one quarter of a basis point for that. So we feel pretty good, and we'll start to see in the next couple of years that the amount that we paid stock and bond managers has actually decreased from this year.
Okay. Representative Uglum.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Very good. It's nice to hear some of your strategy there, and less than a quarter basis point. Looking good. Thank you.
Yes. Mr. Perry.
For the pension plans, the last five fiscal years, We're pretty proud that we've been able to produce an increase of about $20 billion in the market value of the plans over that time period. Net of contributions coming into the plans, we've distributed to the pension plans a little less than $10 billion to make benefit payments to participants. During that same time period, then our non-retirement program, which is basically the area where we fund the Environmental Trust Fund, Closed Landfill Fund, the Permanent School Fund, we've been able to add about $976 million to that pot of money. There have been distributions paid out, of course, and as required by statute. We also manage the state invested treasures account. That's the pot of money that's the cash accounts that everyone uses pretty much for working capital of all the agencies. I think there are about 400 accounts that go through that. That's managed by MMB, but we manage the money, and that's about $10 billion. And we've been able, in this extremely low in interest rate environment, to in the past year, I think we were able to return about $61 million to them. But that we feel pretty good about, given that treasury, short-term treasury assets, most of which we have in that account because of the short-term and very liquid nature of the assets that are needed there. You know, the interest rates have been maybe a little bit better than ought not. So if you look at the next slide, try to give you an overview of, again, what we do. I'm responsible for a staff. My predecessor, Howard Bicker, and I both have run pretty lean shops. I'd say that we have about 30 positions budgeted for. I've been able to identify and have approval from the board to add positions, but we have generally run somewhere in the order of around 25, 26 people, and that's due to the nature of the type of people that we look for to run our investment program. We do have a fair amount of turnover. While we are able to pay our people well, we find that it's very difficult to compete with the investment community here in the Twin Cities. But we believe we've got a pretty good staff. We continue to have turnover in the staff. We're pretty fortunate that in the early 20s, we were put our appropriation from was originally from the legislature, and then in the early 2000s, there was some concern on the part of our Investment Advisory Council and the pension fund directors that we were very much under resourced. There was concern about the turnover. People left because they got better paying opportunities. And at that juncture, there were a lot of discussions amongst those entities with the then Commissioner of Finance and the members of my board. Then at that point in time, the members of the board were Governor Pawlenty, Attorney General Hatch, Secretary of State Kiffmeyer, and State Auditor Anderson. And at that point in time, they made an effort to speak to the legislature, and ultimately we were taken out of the legislative appropriation process except for the 139 that we still get, which goes to pay part of the management of the ITC. And now we have an appropriation. Well, the appropriation is approved by the state board. We use dedicated receipts. The primary people who pay our bills are the pension funds. So we're somewhat held accountable both to the board, and they have the pension funds also have some oversight to us as well. Our salaries are competitively based. There's a salary plan that was put into place, and that's been in place for about 13 years. It's allowed us to maintain a pretty strong staff of people, but we still do get turnover. Since I've been back, we've turned over about half the staff. Some of the people that I've hired in the last 2 years have stayed for a short while and gone on to get better positions. So it's kind of the nature of how our budgeting process runs. So as I said before, what we're primarily responsible for is monitoring the investment performance of our managers. We do manage some of the assets inside, although we're, for some of the assets that we manage internally because of some of the staffing turnover, we're right now going through a process of determining whether or not we should send some of those out and to the passive program that I mentioned earlier, where we're getting some pretty favorable fees. In addition to the pension assets and non-retirement assets, we are responsible for approving and overseeing some of the programs like the investment side of the deferred comp program, the 529 Minnesota College Savings Plan, the health savings care account, and similar programs.
I'm going to pause you 1 second, Mr. Perry. Representative Ulam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Sorry to bother you. Director, when you say you're managing relationships with your investment managers and stuff and monitoring performance, how do you do that? Do you establish benchmarks for performance? Are they sliding benchmarks? How do you monitor the performance of your outside investment managers?
Okay, so Madam Chairman, Representative, as an example, if we hire an active manager, say it's a domestic small cap manager, we manage them to an appropriate benchmark. For a small cap manager, that would be the Russell 1000 value or growth. They get we monitor them against making sure that they're managing in line with that segment of the investment universe, but they are evaluated against the benchmark. The benchmark is without fees, and they get managed on an after-fee basis. And so the primary evaluation is to try to understand how they're making money, if they're making money, but they do get evaluated relative to what essentially would be a passive portfolio in the particular segment that they're in. And we manage, for equities, we do manage monies both domestically and internationally. We manage fixed income, and we do manage, as I said before, private market managers.
Representative Uglum. Mr. Perry.
I think that's all the comments I've got, but I'd be very happy to answer any additional questions.
Mr. Representative Quam.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. And looking at some of the data, full-time salary going from biennium 14-15 to 16-17, there was a 29.3% increase. And going from then to 18-19 over the previous, it was 17.3. If you're going from active to passive, is there more internal management and observation? Is why there's a increase, because these totals are in the millions.
I'm not certain which.
Representative Quam, can you show them? Okay, so that's on. Let's see. I'm not sure he has a copy of that. We go run and give him this.
Madam Chair, it's G38-2000 Operations Investment, and underneath that, that's 41,000 full-time salary, which would be the second line on the sheet that you've just been presented.
So, Representative Klum, I'm thinking it would probably be best for you to repeat that since you just got the document. So what line are you looking at?
Looking on the second line of data coming across and comparing biennium totals and seeing the increases, I noticed that in one of the org charts that I had a partial copy of indicated there was a, you know, one open position, but the increase was you know, fairly substantial, so it looks like it's more than one. You've indicated you've moved from active to passive, and this being, you know, internal salaries, is there an increased amount of internal, you need more personnel to monitor that change in mix?
Yes, I'm not certain which, Madam Chairman, Representative, I'm not certain which org chart you've seen. Since I've taken over the management of the organization, we have had considerable turnover. We budget for a staff of 30, although we believe that there needs to be more resources in the organization. But we generally had between 23 and 26 people in that time period. So what you may be seeing for the bienniums out are our budgeting for a full complement of the 30. Since I've been here, we have added more people to the staff, but you mentioned about a 41% increase. I'm not certain if I heard that correctly.
Representative
Kwan? Thank you, Madam Chair. It was 29, a little bit above 29, a little bit above 17 in the shifts. I was trying to understand, since it's full-time salary, that FTE-type adjustments, and I think you touched on that. The third line from the bottom, it's the consultant fees. There's 41,130 professional tech service outside vendor. That is increasing by, in 16-17 from 14-15, 52.9%. And then when you're going out to, I assume this is your ask for biennium 18-19, it's showing an increase of 169%. And I guess to me that jumps out as being a large increase, and I didn't understand if you could let us know why you're more than doubling that line.
Is that the line that has the 486 for 14, 15, and 16?
Representative Kwan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It does start out with 46. You know, those are annual. So the biennials are 972, 1486, and then 4,000.
Mr. Perry?
Yes, I think that, Madam Chair, our representative, so those are the budget amounts. I'm not certain exactly what's included in there. I believe that that represents a change in the state's budgeting process, where we now pay for services that we hadn't. If I may, I'd like to check that with my CFO, who's behind.
Representative Kwan.
Thank you, and Madam Chair, especially if this reflects a transition in budgeting and expensing that may include other agencies, it would be nice to understand the inferred, you know, large escalation of this line of the budget. And I thank you.
Well, and to that point, just looking at the overall consultant fees, how do we compare to other states of similar size and budget?
Madam Chair, relative to other organizations of our size, I would say that our salaries, there's some higher. There may be a couple lower. We've run a pretty lean shop. And with regards to expenses, I would venture to guess, based on my conversations, you know, we're the one of the 15 largest by assets public pension plans, if you put them all together on the asset side. We're in the top 15 or 20. I would say we would probably be in the bottom half of that in terms of the cost of running the operations.
Representative Nash.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Perry, a quick question for you, and I ask this of everybody, but so your minute expenses, I was just doing some quick mental calculations in my head. They seem to be trending a little bit higher this year over the fiscal 16. A couple questions regarding minute. The services that you do procure from them, we've heard some from some departments that there's not always a lot of great communication back and forth. You could kind of give us how are things working with that, but then also tell us, have you, being fiscally prudent, I love that you're running a tight ship, have you looked at what outside services would be from a price comparison to what you're getting from MIT? So two questions.
Mr. Perry.
Madam Chair, Representative Nash, we do use MIT, but I think that that's primarily just for our email. We're not one of the big users of MIT. I'll again have to refer to, I'll ask him to come and sit next to me, Paul Anderson, my CFO.
You can come to the table, too. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Hi. Paul Anderson, Minnesota State Board of Investment. Yeah, thank you. Representative, Madam Chair, we had previously not used MIT, and we entered into an industry agreement here a couple of years ago with MIT, and we did look at outside fees and got bids, and the price that they could offer for our package for our email server, our Microsoft products, was simply lower than we could get on the private market.
Representative Nash?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. And that's really the crux of the question. You know, the other question that I had was, again, from a mechanics perspective, internal to MIT, when you're talking to them about their recommendations for updates, staffing, and things like that, the number that they give you versus what always gets delivered, is that the same number when they say, oh, we recommend X number of dollars, and is that what you're actually getting from a delivery perspective?
Mr. Anderson.
Madam Chair, Representative, we buy a product, so I'm not exactly sure about all their services they offer. We buy the product that we need, which is, you know, the Microsoft Suite Office and our email, and so we're negotiating with them on a case-by-case basis because we're not, you know, required to be under MIT.
Perfect. Madam Chair.
Representative.
I'm not trying to do a gotcha question. I'm asking this of everybody. I'm kind of, I think, former Representative Kahn called me the newest IT nerd in the legislature. So I'm just trying to make sure that the services that are rendered are costed out accurately and that you're getting what you need.
Yeah, Madam Chair, Representative, we do not enter into everything that they recommend, only the products that we determine through our IT and then even through the retirement systems, ITs as consultants, the products that we need.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Members, any? Oh, Representative Lilly.
Thank you, Chair Anderson. Director Perry, I got a couple questions, but to start, can you tell me a little bit more about the Board Investors Investment Advisory Council and the members, and then maybe the expertise that they would bring to the table and that sort of thing?
Mr. Perry.
Madam Chair or Representative, the Investment Advisory Council is a statutory body that was put in place to assist the members of the board and myself. The composition of it, it's a 17-member advisory council. 10 members of the council come from the public, and the requirement is that they have knowledge in investments and finance. The current members, as I mentioned before, would be the chief investment officers for the pension plans. For our chair is from Target. Other members are from 3M, Cargill, the Margaret A. Cargill Foundation, McAllister College, University of St. Thomas. The commissioner of management and budget, or his or her designee, sits as an ex officio member voting. The three statewide pension directors also are ex officio members, and the governor appoints two active participants and one retiree participant in the plan. We believe that we've got a pretty robust group of people, you know, we meet on a quarterly basis with them prior to a board meeting, and basically go through my work plan for the year. Generally, it's to recommend additional investments or make some changes in the approach that we're taking.
Representative.
Thank you, Chair Anderson, and thank you, Director. Often up here we hear, you know, that government should run more like a business, and so switching kind of to, like, everybody, all our state employees, their 401ks, et cetera. I often wonder, I work for a major employer in our state, and I wonder, you know, we can, like, we can take loans against our stock, and I wonder if that's ever been considered for our investments, if that's ever been considered, because I would imagine that many state employees periodically have some sort of emergency and they maybe want to do a self-loan, or a wedding pops up or something, you know, that they could take a loan against their stock. And I know that's done very much, very often in the private sector, and I wonder why we don't consider offering that to our employees.
Mr. Perry.
Madam Chair, a representative, that would be a question better posed to the pension funds. We manage their assets, but we don't administer the programs.
Okay. Representative.
Thank you, Chair Anderson and Mr. Perry. So my next question probably would be for someone else, too. So you say again who I was supposed to talk to when I'm done. But so my other question is, I can follow up on, I mean, I can check on the Internet on my account also for my other employees' pension. And I can't do that at all. I don't think I'm not able to, that at least at this point. I can literally type in a few seconds. I can, you know, have my balances, and I can move money around in my accounts. And would that be, should I talk to someone else, or is that through you?
Madam Chair, Representative, my understanding, and I'm an employee, so I know I can do it. I'm with me and my staff are part of the state employees retirement system. They administer both the general pension plan and the deferred comp plan and the health care savings plan. I can go online and see what the benefit from the pension plan is projected to be. I can go online in the deferred comp plan and change mutual funds, see what balance it is. So, and same with the health care savings account. I believe that all the plans have this facility, the three major plans.
Ability.
Yes.
And I think Kelly Knight could probably help you to
okay.
represent it a little.
Thank you, Chair. I'm getting kicked underneath the table from our star staff over here, so apparently that was off the mark a little. So
thank you, Mr. Gunn.
And thanks for being nice about it anyways. And usually other members might kind of say, hey, you know, anyways. But, yeah, thank you for the question.
Thank you. Representative Pugh.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Mr. Perry and Mr. Anderson. My question back to the spreadsheet and entitled Expenditures by Appropriation. And my question is with regard to the last two accounts, 41130 and 50. And I see that I'm looking at the biennium by biennium and then to the 2018-19 biennium. And I see that the first account that I mentioned is entitled Outside Vendor. And then I also see that the account underneath it, I'm wondering if that is internal. I guess bottom line is I'm taking a look at the combination of those two accounts and see that we're going from 1550 to about 1800 to more than twice that of 4000, which would be what, 4 million. So I'm just wondering if you could clarify why such a jump from the 2016-17 biennium to the subsequent?
Mr. Perry, do you have where she's looking?
I'm reading that correctly, aren't I?
Yeah, you did.
Madam Chair and Representative, I present you're looking at line 4130. Okay.
That's correct, Madam Chair. Is it
4130
or 41130?
41130 and then 41150. Yes. We employ two investment consultants that work with ourselves, the board, and the IAC. And we recently went through an RFP process for that. When this budget was put together, we were not certain what the cost would be and what you see are budgeted amounts. The numbers that we've negotiated for the two consultants combined over this time period will be significantly less than what you see here. They'll be combined will be less than $1 million each year. So when we were doing the budgeting, we weren't certain what the cost would be based on what organizations are paying their consultants. We believe we budgeted appropriately, and we believe we've handled the situation and negotiated appropriately.
Representative Pugh?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you.
Representative Driscoll.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Perry, I apologize. I came in just a tad late for the presentation, but a question that I have for you as far as, and maybe staff can help me with this too, is there a general fund appropriation for the State Board of Investment, or are in addition to that, as I'm getting a head nod, yes, there is a general appropriation for that or an appropriation. Do you also use any of the funds that are invested and pay or cover your administrative costs, such as a mutual fund might do, where one pays and there may be the internal expense ratios for operating and maintaining and managing? I know that you do pay and are able to buy investments and things and pay for advice and some of those kinds of things, similar to what a mutual fund was doing or would do. Do you do any of that internally with the funds that are collected to cover operating expenses?
Mr. Perry.
Madam Chair, Representative O'Driscoll, we're a pretty cheaply run organization. We do get an appropriation from the general fund. I think that's on the order of $139,000. And we do try to prepare a budget, and when we prepare the budget, that goes through an administrative committee, which are made up of members of the IAC, the pension directors, and the designees of each of the four board members. We go through a process, and we try to identify our costs. The biggest costs we have are staffing costs, which we generally come in significantly under that. I try to budget as though we're going to have a full complement of people, and that gets billed out to everyone that we manage money for, and to the extent that we come in and say that haven't been there in a year where we haven't come in under budget, that gets returned to primarily the pension funds, because they generally upfront the appropriation because they account for, is it
approximately 90%,
89-90% of our costs. So we don't have a direct per basis point charge, but we do work collaboratively with the pension funds to determine what an appropriate budget is. Then has to get approved by the board, but we try to be as low cost as possible.
Representative Driscoll.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, Mr. Perry, if I'm hearing you correctly, you're almost running it like what we used to do with the city called an enterprise fund, where we'd run our sewer and water, where we'd sell a service and we'd bill back for that to the residents and the community. And so you have, although maybe not 100% self-contained, pretty close to 100% self-contained in your operation, administration, and delivery of your service and to the different plans and the annuitants and pensionees.
Mr. Perry.
Madam Chair, Representative O'Driscoll, yes, that would be correct.
Thank you.
Mr. Perry, I just wanted to ask you one question. I am looking at the second page and looking at the rent, and it's fluctuated quite a bit. Is that based on having a different set of FTEs? Is that why? Or can you tell me why it's fluctuated so much? It looks like in fiscal year 2013, it was 194, 2014, 183, then 2015, 222. Can you tell me why the fluctuation? That's under the para office rent. Page 3, uncharged backs, transfers, and interagency agreement.
Madam Chair, in 2015, we did take on more space to accommodate ourselves. And
in 2016?
2015. And 2015, within fiscal 2015, so that's a partial year.
Okay.
And 2016 is the full year.
So is it going to be consistent at the 281 level then?
Yes, we believe so.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Lilly, you've got the final question.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. So a couple years ago, the last few years, I've been serving on the Subcommittee on Employee Relations, and I remember we talked about their pay and their wages, and I remember, you know, not everything we do in the Subcommittee Employee Relations is agreed upon by both sides of the aisle, but on some of the contract stuff. But when we came to the pensions, I remember we, with Mr. Vicker, and I'm sure yours as well, and we were all pretty unanimous on the importance of this role. And I think, I don't know your number, but isn't it like $80 billion you're responsible for? And we had a hard time finding qualified people and make sure we're able to keep them long-term. And really stop and think about the magnitude of this responsibility that these folks have. So thank you for coming. And but anyways, it's I'm probably older than some of you, but you start thinking a lot more about pensions and whatnot, and important for us and our staff, certainly, and thank you.
Ms. Roberts, did you want to add anything else? We've got your documents, but I want to say thank you to Mr. Perry. You've done the most complete of our requests for information so far, so appreciate that piece. But Ms. Roberts, anything else? Okay. Members, any other questions? All right. Thank you, Mr. Perry. Appreciate you guys coming. Thank you, Mr. Anderson.
Thank you very much.
We have Representative Erdahl. Is he still in the room? You're looking very spry today.
Virgil, sorry. Virgil Payne is his name.
Representative Hurd, I'm going to move the House File 148 be recommended without recommendation to the Capital Investment Committee. That's traditionally how we've done it. Okay. And since we've seen this once before, we appreciate brevity as well.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I'm sure we can be brief with this. I'll just give you a real quick overview of what this is. This is a capital budget proposal for restoring historic structures at Fort Snelling, which we, I think, can all agree is one of the most important historic places in Minnesota. These improved facilities will welcome visitors in historic structures adjacent to the historic fort and the Mississippi River. The project will enable the Minnesota Historical Society to reach new audiences by telling a wide variety of stories about Minnesota through the fort's history. We have with us today Minnesota Historical Society Director Steve Elliott to provide more details on the plans for the site.
Mr. Elliott, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and who you represent.
Yes, I'm Steve Elliott. I'm the Director and CEO of the Minnesota Historical Society. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Pleasure to be here with you today, and thank you, Representative Erdahl, for your continued interest and support and for bringing this bill forward today. This is a very important project for Minnesota. What I'd like to do is provide a brief overview of the need for the revitalization project at Historic Fort Snelling, the goals for the project, how we hope to get there. I will be very brief. We appreciate that the support that the legislature has provided for this important project through an appropriation of $500,000 for pre-design in the 2015 special session capital budget bill. Pre-design is complete, and we are poised to proceed. In brief, the project will remove the leaking and sometimes flooded underground visitor center and will provide improved visitor services in restored historic buildings and a 1904 cavalry barracks and an 1880s ordnance building while telling a wider variety of stories, and will improve connections and trails to the Mississippi River and our neighboring parks. With improved facilities, we can better tell the wide range of stories of the diverse people who have inhabited this site over millennia. The total project cost is $46.5 million. Our request to the state of Minnesota is $34 million, and we are prepared to raise an additional $12 million from the private sector. We recognize that this is a significant request. The Minnesota Historical Society is working with our fellow citizens who are willing to put their own resources into the project. This is a departure from the long-time practice of the state of Minnesota's providing the capital funding for the state historic sites. We are committed to doing the hard work required to gather these resources to keep the project on track. I have met with many potential donors, and I am frequently told that they're willing to support the project, want to support the project, but they also want to see the state do its part. We've rallied donors, including six- and seven-figure donors, who are ready to go, but we will lose some of them, and the current momentum for the fundraising for this project if the state funding stalls. So let's not let this opportunity pass to leverage state money with significant non-state funding. A few more thoughts. The Fort Snelling Historic Site is a state responsibility as a place listed in the Historic Sites Network, as defined in statute. It's also worth mentioning, though, that this project has much more than statewide historic significance. It has national significance. It contains the oldest structure in the state, the Round Tower, and the oldest residence, the Commandant's House. What happened at this site formed the basis of what happened in our state for decades and for centuries. As this area changed from Dakota homeland to part of a territory and then the state of Minnesota. Fort Snelling was our state's first national historic landmark, the highest designation conferred by the U.S. Department of the Interior, and most recently the National Trust for Historic Preservation, a national nonprofit group, designated the Fort Snelling area as a national treasure. Why is it important to do this project now? We're working towards revitalizing and repositioning this site for its bicentennial in 2020. Construction began on the fort in 1820. This is the time when Minnesotans will be thinking about the fort, and we should capitalize on that interest and on that milestone to be ready to serve our citizens at the site. The bicentennial will provide an opportunity to reintroduce the site, its broad range of stories, and its refreshed facilities to Minnesotans, and to reposition it as the nationally significant site that it is. If funding is not forthcoming this year, we'll likely miss that opportunity. To date, since the completion of pre-design and the lack of a bonding bill last year, we have kept the design process moving forward with some of the privately raised funds so that the project will continue to be on track for 2020. This project has garnered broad community support and has developed a significant following. You have in your folders letters from a wide variety of organizations, ranging from the Japanese American Citizens League to the Friends of Fort Snelling to the MSP Airport Foundation and many others. And as you will see in your packets, editorial boards from Fargo, Moorhead to Rochester to St. Cloud to the Twin Cities have weighed in with their strong support as well, some repeatedly. There are copies of those editorials in your folder as well. So in closing, we deeply appreciate your interest in and support of this important project. Fort Snelling is a place that is well known and valued by Minnesotans, but it's time to tell the story of everyone who has passed through this important area. Over a span of 10,000 years, whether Dakota, Dred and Harriet Scott, Japanese American linguists at the World War II Military Intelligence Service Language School there, or the thousands of others, veterans, who have a strong personal connection to this important place. Over 100,000 people passed through Fort Snelling on their way to our first large-scale global conflict, World War I, and more than 300,000 on their way to World War II. Literally millions of Minnesotans and other Americans have a direct connection to Fort Snelling. We hope that with your help, we're able to move forward on preserving the state responsibility, taking advantage of the momentum of private fundraising, and keep this National Historic Landmark, where the territory in the state of Minnesota began, on track for its bicentennial. I know that some of you have been to the fort for tours recently, and perhaps for others it's been a while. We'd be pleased to take any of you there on a tour individually or collectively and show you firsthand the work that is planned. In closing, if I may, we have a two-minute video that I think would help you visualize the site and the work that we would like to do there.
And while you're getting that loaded, too, unless you're ready to go, are you ready to go?
Before Minnesota became Minnesota, there was a place, a confluence of two great rivers, where cultures and civilizations crossed for thousands of years, where something new was imagined, a remote American outpost built, a place of pride and sorrow.
It's a place of rebirth and birth, but it's also a place of great tragedy.
Historic Fort Snelling, Minnesota's first National Historic Landmark. In 2020, Fort Snelling will be 200 years old. In time for its bicentennial, we have a new, expanded vision for the site, where visitors connect with each other, with the many stories that bind us together, with the natural beauty of this extraordinary place. Our plan includes a new visitor center to replace inadequate and aging facilities, places for private reflection and public remembrance, a reimagined visitor experience sharing more complete stories of the diverse people who shaped our state and country.
Did you find it surprising that we did actually have slaves here at Fort Snelling?
Stories of the many soldiers who prepared here to fight for America. Soldiers who are buried nearby. With new investment, historic Fort Snelling will attract more of the millions who pass through this busy corridor every year. By sharing an American story told nowhere else. With its bicentennial on the horizon, help us realize the potential of this unique place and position historic Fort Snelling for the next century and beyond.
Again, thank you, Madam Chair and Committee, for your time today. We appreciate the opportunity to tell you about this, and Representative Erdahl, thank you so much for your continued support.
Thank you, Mr. Elliott. And members, we went over quite a bit in the, was it last session or the session before that, kind of what led up to this point and the design of it. So if you're interested in kind of looking at that piece, you can find that in the previous committee testimony that we've had. I just don't think that we want to belabor that today. So it's out there. It's accessible, so you'd be able to review it for yourself. But members, do you have any questions on this project at all? Representative Uglum.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, not really a question, but just a little background. The bonding committee did tour this site, when was it, Dean? Summer before, I guess. And if you haven't been to Fort Snelling, it's a truly, the video, you get an idea, but it's a great spot. And obviously the visitor center, you saw just a snippet of how bad a shape it is in. I think it's highly recommended for most members of the bonding committee that this project move forward for the bicentennial. Thanks.
Representative Kunesh Kodin.
Thank you. Thank you. You mentioned how you are going to incorporate the voices of the past at Fort Snelling. And I'm specifically most interested in finding out how you are going to share the voices of the Dakota people that were there in the beginning as a very proud descendant of the Dakota. I would like to hear just how it is that you are going to give them an authentic voice and share the authentic history that happened in Fort Snelling, because as you mentioned in there, it was very tragic. And just in your depictions and some of the glossy pictures, I didn't see any of that.
Mr. Ellie or Representative Erdahl? Mr. Elliott?
Madam Chair, thank you. It's an excellent question. As I think you can tell from our presentation, one of our ambitions is to expand the interpretation of Fort Snelling so that it covers is much more comprehensive and covers better than does a better job than we've done in the past of letting folks know that this was Dakota homeland. This still is Dakota homeland. And that people lived, archaeologically, we know that people have been there for more than 10,000 years. It is a site that is not only Dakota homeland, but there is a creation story for some Dakota that they came from an island at the confluence of the rivers. And there continued to be a place after contact with whites, great contact, and other important stories that Fort Snelling connects to. And we are looking to build on that and build those interpretations and programs with the Dakota people. We have been in conversation with our Indian Advisory Committee, which has representatives appointed by the tribal councils from each of the tribal communities, and a Dakota advisory group has just met for the first time, had 25 Dakota people that came for that, because we don't want to be telling your stories. We want you to work with us on how that can best be done at the site and how the site can be used, can also be made available to Dakota people for ceremony and for meeting and dialogue. So We take that very seriously. We also have community engagement ongoing with the African-American community and the Japanese-American community because they have important stories to tell there, too. And we want them to help tell the stories, and we want to want Fort Snelling to be a place that is embraced by all of these communities.
Representative.
Thank you very much. I'm glad to hear that you are taking this into strong consideration in your planning. Thank you.
Representative Flanagan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think my question is along the same lines as Representative Kunesh-Podein. Fort Snelling is a complicated place. My great-grandfather is buried there on my mom's side. And on the other side, it's hard for me to even spend time there because we think of the families, the women, the children, the folks who were there before the largest mass execution in the history of this country with the Dakota 38. And so when I think about Fort Snelling, I appreciate having the voice of the Dakota people being part of the storytelling of what happened there. But also think there's a responsibility for us to continue to talk about the Dakota people who are still here. It's not just about history, and I think sometimes that's when we get into a tricky spot, that Native people are people of the past, and yet we have five Indigenous people who serve in the legislature, three on this committee. I think that there's a real opportunity to also tell the story about the fact that we're still here. So I'm really eager. I know some of the folks who've been working with you and some of the people that you've brought out in the Historical Society, who I respect tremendously. I'm excited to see Joe Horse Capture is now at the Historical Society. And so I think myself and other folks, Native folks who are here and in the legislature would be interested in being part of that work. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Lilly.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. I agree with what Representative Ugram was saying about the support on the Capital Investment Committee. And Mr. Elliott, I was wondering if you had a comment. You know, I know one of your goals is to be able to have this all up and running by the time of the celebration. So we missed last year's cycle on the capital investment. I'm just wondering if you have a drop-dead date or where we just are not going to be able to, if we do get a bill this session or if we don't get a bill this session, what happens? Are you going to be successful in being able to complete if we do it in next year in 2018? Or I'm just be curious if you have a comment.
Mr. Elliott.
Madam Chair, Representative Lilly, it's an excellent question. As I mentioned, we have continued the design process with privately raised funds so that if there is a bill this session, we would able to have this project, as you saw it envisioned, completed for the bicentennial in 2020. Cutting it close, I think we're going to get there. If there were not a bill this session, I'm not sure that this project as conceived could be completed for 2020. Mm-hmm. We'd have to go back to the drawing board, probably carve out a piece of it, and think about something that's partially ready by then. That would be that'd be very sad because it would be a missed opportunity.
Representative Lilly.
Thank you, Chair Anderson. And I know certainly there was wide support on the Capital Investment Committee, and I know for sure that Chair Erdahl's himself for it. I just questioned some of his leadership team on this. So anyways, hopefully they deliver and
let's get her done.
Let's get her done.
With that, I'm going to renew my motion that House file. Oh, excuse me, Representative Fenton.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Mr. Elliott. Could you talk about the plan for long-term operating costs going forward, should you get the funding to build this beautiful building?
Mr. Elliott.
Yes. So looking at the long-term operating costs is a part of the project planning. We are, and as well as looking at attendance projections, ancillary activities, et cetera. We believe that we can execute this project and not increase the operating deficit of Fort Snelling. You really don't operate these sites on a positive net revenue basis, but we believe that we can keep that that margin about what it is today.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Omar, and then we are going to move the bill. Representative Omar.
Thank you, Chair. I'm curious, and you might have already mentioned the votes, but how many visitors does the fort get per year?
Fort gets about 85,000 visitors a year now. That visitorship has declined in recent years as the site has needed refreshment. We believe we can get it back up to 125,000 or more. As we have better facilities and richer stories that we're telling there. And there are a lot of school kids from all around the state that come to Fort Snelling.
Madam Chair, what kind of revenue is generated from any of that, if any?
Mr. Elliott.
Madam Chair, I'm David Kelleher from the Minnesota Historical Society. I don't have revenue figures at my fingertips right now, but we certainly generate revenue from admissions, sales in the shop, and with an expanded facility, we would be able to generate additional revenue through events and, as Steve said, through ancillaries and other activities on the site.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Madam Chair.
Representative
Erdogan. Just real quickly, for those members who don't understand the need for a new visitor center, the current visitor center was built, I believe, in the 1970s. It was built partly underground, which is kind of a style in those days, and it's at the confluence of two rivers, and it has leaking problems. There are three sump pumps that run continuously in the visitor center, and at times parts of it have to be closed down because of flooding, and that's why they need to redo and have another visitor center.
And thank you, Representative Erdahl. And that's why I think it would be important for members to review the past committee, because we talked about the design. Basically, they have the two trails that go into it going down. So anybody knows from designing a building, that's probably not the best thing to do in Minnesota, land of sogginess. So it is flooded. I do encourage you to go out there. It is a great family activity to do if you haven't been there. It'll give you a better picture of what we're talking about here today. With that, thank you, Representative Erdahl. I'm going to renew my motion that your bill, House File 148, be referred to the Committee on Capital Investment without recommendation. All those in favor, please. Well, we don't have to vote, do we? We don't have to vote on that, I don't think. No. So that's what we're going to do. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Members, we are going to go to CGIP. Ms. Saunier.
Do you have to vote?
We do. Okay. All right. We've got to make sure we're doing this right. Again, my motion is to send the bill to Capital Investment Committee without recommendation. All those in favor,
Madam
say
Chair.
Aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Okay. Representative Lilly? We just want to make sure we're doing it right. Are you good?
No. Madam Chair, I was just going to ask prior to the vote if that's the tradition to do it without recommendation, because I think there's pretty wide support on this committee to actually send it with recommendation. So
that's been our tradition in this committee. Every bonding bill that we've had come through, we don't have a recommendation. So I'm just following what our tradition has been here.
Even though you have
You serve on
wide,
capital
wide
investment,
support.
Don't you?
I do.
You do? Well, you'll have a chance to say your piece there.
Okay.
Awesome. Great. With that, it is Sonia, right?
That's correct, Madam Chair.
Okay. Ms. Sonia, if you want to start your presentation, please.
Sure. Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Julie Sonia, and I'm the director of the State Employee Group Insurance Program, or CGIP, at Minnesota Management and Budget. I was here last week, and at the end, it was at the very end of the hearing, and gave a very brief overview, and I don't want to be too repetitive of what I said last week, but just sort of as a quick recap, CGIP offers comprehensive insurance benefits to ensure that state employees and their families have access to quality insurance at an affordable cost. These insurance benefits include health, dental, short and long-term disability, life insurance, and long-term care insurance. We spend about $860 million in the most recently completed fiscal year, and about 90% of that was for health insurance. And so we spend a lot of our time on health insurance. We cover employees in the executive, legislative, and judicial branches of state government, as well as employees of the Minnesota State Colleges and Universities system. In all, we have about 127,000 people who are covered by our health insurance. That includes employees, retirees, and dependents. I spoke a little bit last week, and I'd be happy to answer any questions about some of the strategies that we use to contain health care cost growth. But just as a very quick recap, those include pushing our health plans to do more to pay health care providers based on the value of care rather than simply the volume of services that's provided. Our benefit design, which encourages employees to use the most efficient clinics. So we have a benefit design where the deductibles and copays are lower for members that use the lowest cost clinics, is another important cost containment mechanism. About 90% of our employees, of our members, currently use clinics in cost levels 1 and 2. So we view that as a very effective cost containment strategy over time. A third way is by holding our vendors accountable. So through our contracting with our health plan administrators, looking at what it is that we want them to be achieving on our behalf and incorporating appropriate financial incentives into those contracts. And then finally, through chronic disease prevention. And I mentioned briefly last week the diabetes prevention program that we implemented in 2015 that's been very successful and that we view as helping to contain long-term cost growth by preventing state employees from getting expensive chronic diseases like diabetes. Our insurance benefits are collectively bargained, typically on a two-year cycle that matches the state's biennial budget. The benefits are uniform across the different labor contracts and compensation plans, and so they are bargained with the coalition of all of the labor unions. The labor contracts and plans, of course, must also be approved by the legislature. Our medical plan, which is called the Minnesota Advantage Health Plan, is a self-insured plan. That means that the state is financially at risk for the cost of medical claims. We contract with three health plan administrators, Blue Cross Blue Shield of Minnesota, Health Partners, and Preferred One, to provide administration services, which includes activities like claims processing, case management, negotiating the provider network, and what the payment rates are going to be with the healthcare providers. They perform those, that we pay them to do those administrative services on our behalf, and we pay claims through them, but we are the ones who retain the financial risk associated with those actual claims costs. In 2002, we implemented this purchasing model with the tiered provider network that encourages members to use more cost-efficient healthcare providers by assigning clinics to cost tiers and then providing our enrollees with incentives to use the more efficient providers. The way that this works is that every year we analyze our claims data to determine how different clinics are performing on cost. And that analysis is very complicated and includes things like a risk adjustment process to make sure that clinics that take care of sicker patients aren't penalized for doing that. But the results of this analysis form the basis for assigning clinics to cost tiers for the upcoming year. The clinics then have the opportunity, if they want to negotiate special arrangements for placement into a lower cost tier. We have many, many provider clinics who take advantage of that because they see the value to our members and how attracted our members are to the providers that are placed in the lower cost tiers. And then finally, we also every year assign some clinics to a lower cost level to make sure that all of our members have access to at least a cost level 2 clinic within 30 miles of every work site. Unlike narrow provider networks, which are becoming common in some other parts of the health insurance market, our tiered provider networks still give CGIT members access to a broad array of providers while at the same time still driving towards greater efficiency. And then unlike in some higher deductible plans, our plan also holds providers accountable for reducing inappropriate utilization rather than just the members through their out-of-pocket cost sharing. Because our health insurance plan is a self-funded plan, we have to maintain a contingency reserve to cover unexpectedly high medical claims costs. There's quite a bit of uncertainty involved in projecting medical costs, and this is increased by the fact that we have to set premiums well in advance of the time period for which they're being collected. An example might help to make that more clear. So in the summer of 2016, we set premiums for 2017, and it was based on the best available information we had at the time. But that was 2015 costs, and you know, a little bit of information maybe about the first quarter of 2016. So that lag between the data that you have available at the time you have to make that decision, as well as the long time period that passes, for which you're covering the premiums, means that you have to be really careful about making sure that you have adequate reserves to pay the claims. In the late 1980s, it was the case that CGIP's self-funded plan experienced a $50 million shortfall that required a special appropriation from the legislature. The contingency reserve target that we have now is 16.7% of claims, or it's two months' worth of claims costs, is intended to avoid the need for any such infusions of funds from the legislature in the future. You should all have a handout that shows current financial information for CGIP, including our projections through 2021. The handout shows our revenues and expenses for each year, and I want to draw your attention particularly to the bottom section that's labeled contingency reserves. This is where we do a calculation that compares our actual reserve to the target amount that I just described of 2 months' worth of claims. At the end of 2015, the reserves were just about at the target level. And for 2016, our most recent projections show that reserves were expected to be $20 million below the target at the end of the year. The main reason why this happened was that expenditures in 2015 were higher than projected. So they were projected to grow at about 5.3% in 2015, and instead they grew by 7.4%. Partly this was because of faster growth across the entire Minnesota market, so all the health plans in the marketplace experienced higher than expected growth in that year, and partly it was because we had an unusual number of high-cost cases in 2015. In any case, by the time we had that information, we had already had to set the 2016 premiums, and this is a good example of why the contingency reserve is important, because small shifts in spending can add up very quickly, and because it can be a long time before premiums can be adjusted to the right level. Health insurance premiums increased by 8.7% on January 1st of this year, and we're currently forecasting an additional 8.7% increase in 2018. And together, those two increases will bring the contingency reserve back to the target level by the end of 2018. I should note, however, that these projections will almost certainly change. We will have some preliminary projections for actual cost growth in 2016 around the end of February, and we'll also get new forecasted growth rates for 2017 and 2018 around the end of April. And at that time, we'll have a much better picture, I think, of what premiums are likely to be in 2018. That concludes my prepared remarks. Thank you for the opportunity to come back and provide more detail to the committee.
Ms. Sonia, I want to focus more on the contingency reserve piece. So where do you get the advice that the 2 month is the appropriate amount? Is that kind of standard in the industry, or, you know, where does that come from, choosing that as your basis?
Madam Chair and members of the committee, that recommendation comes from our actuarial consultants. They actually recommend a range that could go as high as 30%. So we are towards the lower end of that range. There is no, like, one single accepted industry standard, but we're certainly at the lower end of the range of what they recommend.
And I see that in 2014 you were at the 22.5%. What was it prior to that? What was the standard prior to that?
Madam Chair, the target level of the reserve has been 16.7% for many years. Am I misunderstanding the question?
So what was the amount that you had, actual amount, in 2013, 2012, 2011, so forth?
Madam Chair, I believe for some time the percentages were higher, and in a way that was good news. So there were several years after 2010 when healthcare spending growth grew much more slowly than projected. And so there were also several years during that time period when we had 0% premium increases, and still the reserve was above the target. So state employees were able to enjoy several years of essentially no premium increases as a result of that.
Could we get that back, going back to 2006?
Madam Chair, certainly.
Okay. Members, Representative Nash.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Sonia, keeping true to my word, I'm asking everybody who comes about their interaction with Minute, because it's kind of my pet project, but if you could tell us what you utilize from Minute, how's it going, and have you looked at outside costs relative to what you're being charged from Minute, And then I'll have a follow-up question on another issue.
Ms. Sonia?
Madam Chair and Representative Nash, we have a couple of sort of main ways that we use Minute. One is just for, you know, regular sort of personal computer support, but the bigger way is through the statewide systems that we rely on. So one of the main ways that we do our business is through the state's personnel system. That's how people enroll in their benefits, and that's how the benefits are administered. And so we are one component of that system, and so it also includes all of the state's HR and the hiring functions and the payroll and all of that. So we're one component of that system. Certainly there's a number of competing priorities for, there's always projects and things that different people need from the system. And so it's really a question of, you know, which projects take the highest priority and making sure that the system is up to date and functioning for everyone.
Representative Nash.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My follow-up to the Minute question, then I will have another one, is Minute administering your 1095C project, or are you doing that internally? Because the 1095As from last year were a little bit wonky, so I'm just wondering if they're handling your Cs as well.
Ms. Sonia?
Madam Chair and Representative Ness, yes, we do get very substantial support from Minute for the 1095Cs. That is a combination of our own internal staff who sort of know our systems really well and the regulatory requirements and support from Minute to actually run the software that generates the forms. But yes, they have a very substantial role in that.
Representative Nash?
Madam Chair, on a separate issue, Ms. Sonia, can you tell us what your budget for postage, advertising, and things like that are? Because I have a mail piece that I got from you when I first joined the legislature, and I'm just wondering what that is, and then I have a follow-up question on that.
Ms. Sonia?
Madam Chair and Representative Nash, we do very little direct mail to our enrollees. So once each year at open enrollment, people get a hard copy of the open enrollment newsletter, which is the only hard copy thing they get from us about open enrollment. And then we've also got the 1095Cs, which are being mailed out, although we've been pretty successful this year in getting people to opt into doing that electronically. I think you may be referring to the outreach that was for part of that diabetes prevention program. We certainly heard a lot about that mailing at the time that it went out. The cost for that was borne by the vendor for that program, and the vendor is paid only for outcomes. So there was no additional cost that was paid by the state for that mailing.
Ms. Sonia, how much have you spent on advertising then?
Madam Chair, we don't do any advertising. We have a quarterly newsletter that comes out, but that's sort of regular staff time.
How much did you spend on that?
Madam Chair, as I just explained, we didn't spend any money on that. The vendor paid for that, and they absorbed the cost of that, and they're only paid based on program outcomes.
And what was the program outcome pay?
Madam Chair, I don't have that with me. I can find that for you. But it's based on participation and enrollees who achieve certain milestones. And so if the vendor is able to keep the employee engaged for a certain amount of time, they get one payment. And then the rest is based on achieving targets such as like a 5% weight loss or a 10% weight loss. And, again, sort of keeping them engaged to the end of the program.
Can you do me a favor in looking back to at least the last 5 years? Any other models of I would consider it advertising if you have an outside vendor that does it and it's based on performance pay, what those amounts have been, what has been our incentive pay as a result of the outcomes that they've been able to produce?
Madam Chair, I'd be happy to do that. That's the only example I'm aware of where a vendor was paid on outcomes in that way.
Okay. Representative Nash, sorry.
Madam Chair, you asked all the follow-up questions, but you're the chair.
You drew my interest.
I'm good. I'm all out of questions. Well, maybe I'm not. I love acronyms, but for the life of me, I don't know what DIVA is. Can you?
Ms. Sonia.
As it relates to your budget item, could you tell us what that is?
Madam Chair and Representative Ness, I'd be happy to. It stands for the Dependent Verification Audit, and that was a process that we went through with an outside contractor at the direction of the legislature. I believe it was in 2011 and 2012. And it was to ensure that all of the dependents who are enrolled in our program are, in fact, eligible for the program. So there was an outside contractor used at that time. We're also required to verify dependent eligibility on an ongoing basis, but we do that with in-house resources.
I'm all good.
Representative O'Driscoll.
How do you follow that act?
I can.
Madam Chair, Ms. O'Neill, one of the questions that I have, because of the contingency reserves, has CGIP ever or has there been any research done about buying reinsurance instead of trying to hold the reserves themselves and shift some of that and get more predictability in the premiums and the predictability in the management and inflow and outflow of funds for the program?
Ms. Sonia?
Madam Chair and Representative, we actually do buy reinsurance. It kicks in at a very high level, though, so it would only kick in if our aggregate claims were more than 25% above the projected level. So we still need that sort of protection sort of between the projected claims and the and when the reinsurance policy would kick in.
Representative Driscoll.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Follow-up question to that. As is oftentimes the case with deductibles, because that's what we're looking at in more of an aggregate or broad picture, do you know what the next step down would be in the cost in the savings or the for analysis? Has anybody looked at that?
Ms. Stoner?
Madam Chair and Representative Driscoll, I'm not sure I understand the question.
You were saying that if it was more than 25% of the anticipated claims that were there, is there a way of buying insurance at 15 or 10 or 12 or 17? And do we know what the difference on that would be in the cost savings and what that might do to contingency reserves?
Ms. Sonia?
Madam Chair and Representative, we can certainly look at that. I don't believe it's been looked at recently.
Representative Driscoll? Okay. Representative Kwan?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And this is a useful form. I thought I heard a number around 129K or so. Is that employees or policies or individuals?
Ms. Sonier?
Madam Chair and Representative Quantum, that is individuals. So the number of employees who are covered is about 54,000, and the total, including early retirees and dependents, is 127,000.
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And, you know, so looking at this, that's about 6,000 in claims paid. And probably offline, if you get percentages of how many of these are family and individual, and then since you go through and you look at deductibles and you keep track of copays, if you had a total of those for a year, then we'd be able to understand here's what was paid, here's what is out of pocket. So for this 127, mm-hmm. you know, for this quantity of people, this was the total medical expenses, and that's how those things have changed, you know, and the total cost. So, you know, that type of thing, you know, if you could give offline, it lets us see a bigger picture, and I'm amazed with how little this really cost the, you know, the state. To do so.
Ms. Sonier, does
some good stuff.
Do you?
Madam Chair and Representative Clem, I'd be happy to get you that information about sort of, if I understand the question correctly, it's about sort of the total amount that healthcare providers got paid and how much of that was paid by CGIP versus members. And to answer your question about single versus family coverage, about 40% of our members have, 40% of employees carry single coverage and 60% carry family coverage.
Representative Clem?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, this is very good data to work with.
Members, Representative Lilly.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I was wondering if you could tell me, like the reserves, where's that money come from? Is that stuff that the legislature that we piled gave you a big pile of money, or is that come from the feds, or where's that money? Where's that money coming from? And,
Madam Chair and Representative, that money is included in the premiums. So the premiums are set in such a way as to be able to pay for medical claims, to be able to pay for the administration of the plan, and to maintain an adequate reserve.
Representative Lilly.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And then so the premiums, I'm guessing, are paid for by the consumers, which would be employees. Is that correct? Go ahead.
Madam Chair and Representative, yes. So, well, for employees who qualify for the employer contribution, the state pays part of the premium, and employees pay part of the premium.
Representative Lilly.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, how much would be paid by half and half? just be curious.
Ms. Sonia.
Madam Chair and Representative, for an employee who has single coverage, if they're working full-time, they would pay 5% of the premium. And that same employee, if they carried family coverage, would pay an additional 15% towards the extra cost that their family covers. And so when you, for family coverage, it's sort of a weighted average of that 5% and 15%. It works out to about 11% of the cost of family coverage that's paid by an employee.
Thank you. Madam Chair, so I know it's early in the game and you haven't had your target set or anything along that line. And last year I know from reading that we kind of found some, you know, went after that. That was one of your targets, I think, for try to balance your budget or to achieve your target for your committee. And I'm just curious if that's part of your plan this year or if you have other ideas. It just seems like we might, if we are, it seems like there might be a more sensible place than from money that's contributed by the employees, perhaps. But maybe I'm new, so maybe I don't understand it. But I'm happy to listen. But do you intend to probably pursue this again this session, given the surplus and these sort of things, Madam Chair?
And Representative Lilly, if I might, before we get into that, can we just ask if other members have questions and then we can excuse poor Ms. Sonia? Does that work for you?
That's fine. I'm happy. I'm just was happy with a yes or no answer, but apparently you want to give more. Go ahead.
Sure. Members, any other questions for Ms. Sonia? All right. Thank you. Appreciate you coming by.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Lilly, to your question, we haven't gotten a target. When we do, I'm looking forward to any suggestions that you have in meeting that target.
Okay. Well, Madam Chair?
Mm-hmm.
Madam Chair, I was wondering if that was that a suggestion? I wasn't on the committee last year. Did the DFL suggest that we cut from there? I was just wondering, or did that come from your side?
I'm trying to remember. I don't think there wasn't a proposal that met the target from your side, but you're welcome to put forward any proposal that meets the target that we are given as a committee.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Members, any other questions? With that, we are adjourned.